Moonfest Destiny, number 15. Moonfest Destiny is a novel by me, Peter Gelman. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. Thanks. Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. Chapter 14. Prince President Franklin Stove hits a humdinger. The next morning was strangely quiet. What were them Mooner men up to now, we wondered. Kelly strode down from the ramparts and told me it was nothing at all. Just that all of General Lunarista's thousands and thousands of musketeers, in fact, the entire army of the Sea of Tranquility, every single man on the far shore of the Mare Frigoris, was down on his knees praying. This strange behavior kind of spooked me, and spooked lots more besides just me. So Major Jake Brown had us assemble again and tried to rouse our gumption. "Men," he told us, "I must congratulate every one of you. And the ladies, too," he added with a friendly smile. "Our fort is finished. I mean complete," he smiled. "And the Lunar Peninsula of Texas secure. You all deserve a reward for your hard work. So, all men, excepting those now on duty, are granted 1/2 hour of liberty. Just keep your muskets handy. We will have a second 1/2 hour of liberty this afternoon at 1, so don't fret. Those of you on duty now." "Oh, yes. Artillery crews," they groaned knowingly, for Major Ringgold had imparted a philosophy of drilling and drilling to the point of making his gunners automata. That Captain Loud continued. "All watches, run through your drills. After staff council, Captain Lloyd will reassess your targets. Staff council at the flagpole in 5 minutes. All soldiers and their wives, servants, slaves, and automatons are invited inside the shady bomb-proof gallery, where Reverend McKnight will read you the responsibilities of a Christian non-combatant in a time of adversity." Dismissed! We hadn't had any liberties at all since we marched down from Annex Agonies to the tip of Timmy's Promontory. Well, we all ran amuck, making the best of our liberty. Some of the men sat down for big hands of poker inside a tent. Some found shade along the eastern wall since the sun was just rising and dozed off. Some formed a ring around 2 bare-chested pugilists. Some few even sat down with Martha Miles, who was as regularly reading Maria Monk's awful disclosures aloud, for which McKnight, being particular because his sister was in just such a Montreal nunnery, wouldn't speak to her, and organized his rival reading. And some, myself included, collected around the Cactus Queen, Sarah, my famous camp wife. She offered to teach Company A and Company C how to play this newfangled divertissement called baseball. She had learned it from one of her husbands, at Anagaraxis Crater, a Yankee, that one, who deserted. So a few dozen of us doughboys collected down at the empty stretch of yard under Gun Platform 6, behind Martha Mule's little bomb-proof-like corral. We gathered round and got all morsed about learning this thing, this baseball, which was locomotin', our young American generation. Just like the Gay Paris Waltz knocked the pantaloons off the bank-slaying generation. The proof in the bomb-proof was that every generation's got to set a bomb to the ways of the older generation. That's true up and down, whether it be ballooning to Venus and the moon and tarnation, like we young Americans were doing with or without the old Whigs, or slaying banks like Andy Jackson did despite the Maybobs, or repealing penny tariffs and sedition laws, or exchanging an articled confederation for a federated union, or even kicking the old Tories, their snuff boxes full of taxes, and their king the heck back to great Deimos. Not only did Sarah have her Colt repeater, her Apache scalp, her Chinese abacus, and the rattle from a rattlesnake, but she produced a large black ball made of smelly Saturn caoutchouc, which is pronounced catchouc. But since the majority of us were partial to the noble feline race, we took exception to this and held a meeting, appointed speakers, one for, one against, and took a vote, and decided to call our ball the friendly name George Washington, on account of we were his children, the newspaper said, and we were doing his work. Anyway, Sarah's baseball looked like a 5-pound solid shot to me. She directed Sergeant Rutherford Weigart, the gambling gunner and biped lightning rod, now waiting in the shade of the number 2 guns, while the other watch rolled the cannon forward and back. Rutherford loaned us his spare wadding bunger, a kind of stout oaken mop for one of the electromagnetics. Fortunately, Captain Loud, commander of the artillery company, was away at the flagpole, so he couldn't see what abuse his equipment would suffer. "Hush now," called Sarah, "and I will now endeavor to explain to y'all the 10 principles of this here baseball, which I learnt back at Camp Annex Agonies from a feller called Abner in Company E of the 1st Artillery. He's the only grease-stained Yankee I know who invented anything useful. No offense, Professor," she added with a wink at the Prince President, Franklin Stowe, whose ever benign porcelain countenance made no response other than to jet a little steam from the escape pipes of his nostrils. "Y'all will like this. It's a game concerning homesteading the frontier. Y'all is two rival wagon trains aiming to settle the same piece of land." She scratched something in the dirt with her bare heel. It looked like the front end of a church. "Rule number 1, she said, counting on her thumb, "concerning homestead. This here's called homestead, and it's where you start, and it's where you aim to finish. This is where the pioneer stands. He's a kind of immigrant, and he's kind of artillery, too. This is where he makes his stand and fights off the attack of this here ball. Rule number 2, concerning the 3 forts along the way. Now, if that pioneer whacks that ball back at the engines, sending them running after that ball, back from the reservation, the farther the better. If he can do that, he can run all hell-bent for glory to make that first frontier fort, called simply a base, where he's safe from the savages. Once there, he can turn his eyes on the next base. Sometimes he can go ahead and run for her, sometimes he can't, which is explained in the 3rd rule. Let's say them empty water barrels is the 1st base. The mule's ditch is 2nd. Don't fall in, boys. And the 3rd is the busted chuck wagon. She tapped her 3rd finger. Rule number 3, concerning the 3 seasons and winter. There's 3 seasons in this here baseball. Spring, summer, and fall, which we number 1, 2, and 3. Furthermore, we call them outs because that's when your pioneer can get outside. After fall, then, which is our number 3, you got to hole up and wait until spring again. That's winter. And that's when the 2 rival wagon teams change over, and the other folks play engines, and the other folks play at homesteading. The seasons advance every time a homesteader gets a free Apache haircut. I'm talking about scalp, boys. I'm talking about every time a homesteader gets killed, that's another out. Get it? Because the folks got to bury him and all that. They lose time. Hush now, I'm getting to the good part. Rule number 4. Concerning the 4 ways to get an Apache haircut. I'm going to summarize them as follows. You run out of ammunition because you only got 3 shots. You shoot bad and miss your targets, in which case your targets hit you. You run for a base, but you get ambushed first. And if you're a slowpoke, you can get betrayed by your friends and thrown out of a fort that's too crowded. Instantly, we regulars understood the principles of baseball. Hardly had she explained a rule when it was as if we already known it. Deep down, it was just like our manifest destiny. Running immigrants from fort to homestead was like adding stars to Old Glory's collection. Naturally, it was a contest, too, to see just whose pioneers would dominate the territory's constitutional convention and decide free or slave. Sarah found her last finger. And finally, rule number 10, striking gold. Every pioneer's got one dream. Now, if he is strong enough or lucky enough and hits the ball over that wall yonder, well, that's called a humdinger. And that feller gets to drive and drive all his wagons and his friends' wagons round all the three forts to Homestead. He done struck gold on his land, as it were. And any mortal, metal, or Yankee can do that against one of my own patented red-hot cannonballs. I will personally award him $10 and a purdyscript issued in the State Bank of Texas, an edifice of brick. I will do that because I am one lady who is very hard to impress. And yet, I have never seen nobody hit a humdinger off of the likes of me. Don't you skinny cotton balers make me wait too long now to give away my purdy $10 note. She tossed George Washington, the ball, in the air to give us time to think about her reward. Caught it, and explained a few more things. Keep it clean and Christian and mind your manners. No cussing, no fighting, and no spitting. Button up your uniforms. Let them superstitious scallywagging little lunars bless their firecrackers. Boys, we defenders of our star-spangled banner will enjoy our new American invention called baseball right here on American soil, even if we is on the moon. All right now. I'll pitch for Company A, then, the Calhounian Crawdads. Professor Metal, I figure you to pitch for Company C, the Henry Clay Chickenhawks. All right now, play ball, boys. Hang 'em high, Crawdads. Hip hoorah for the Hawks. Naturally, we asked Sarah to go west first. She gave her revolver to me to hold, rubbed dirt in her palms, tested her grip on the electromagnetic wadding bunger, swinging it back and forth with a cheerful grin. Satisfied, she walked over to the homestead, dug her feet in, loosening her skirts. She tested her swing one more time. After adding some spit to the dirt, the cheerful grin grew mean. Tick, stick, stick, tick, ick, ick, pondered Prince President Franklin Stove, calculating for a short while. And threw George Washington nice and easy, straight as a whistle. Sarah whirled the oaken bunger. What happened was a miraculous thing to behold. There was a small explosion on the ball. Flew past the ticking metal man, past Corporal O'Harris at the second base, into the unfinished well pit, whacked poor old Martha Mule, who sawed the air with her disapproving grunts and hooves. But the ball didn't stop. It then sailed up and up, followed by down and down, slow as you please, and Six Fingers Bordet plucked it out of the sky like a trapeze artist taking the hand of his flying sweetheart. He beamed as we all, Crawdads and Chicken Hawks alike, cheered him. A rare event for a Mormon. He felt so charitable he kissed Martha's nose and Sarah's knuckle, not once, but twice and again, with a respectful nod at me. Just so that Sarah didn't think I thought I was a cuckolded husband in addition to being her latest lucky fool, I yelled, "Huey, does that S on your sleeve mean Sarah done branded you next?" "That's not how I brand 'em. I go and do it like this," called Sarah, and put her arms around Bordet's chicken head, she being so much taller, and kissed one of his protruding ears. This caused much barnyard clamor, which aggrieved me sorely. Fortunately, I had something to occupy my red-faced attentions. For the first time in my hands, that shiny new soldier's toy, the Colt repeater of Sarah's, I gave the drum a couple spins. I sighted it appraisingly along the barrel, of a necessity pointing it in a general way toward the Mormon. I was fourth in line to go west, But now, Sergeant Mallory, the big fiend with a tree trunk for a head and frigates for fists. Took up the big wadding bunger. He swung that bunger like a Highlander's two-handed battle cleaver. Our heads all swung round to the south, expecting a humdinger for sure. But PPFS had by now built up some steam. General Washington whizzed by like lightning, making a little thunder crack in the catcher's bare hands. Mallory spun around and fell down. Oh, how we laughed. Poor Half-Lip McCoy, the Chicken Hawk hell catcher, wrung the pain out of his hands, catching all three of Mallory's misfires. The 100 or so doughboys who all watched on the slopes of the fort, a natural arena, hooped and hollered and danced jigs and offered odds. I saw Sergeant Weigert, the gunner up there, waiting for his turn to drill. He saw me and held up my bad luck charm and kissed it. Looked bad for my wager. Lightning rod, I called. Alan Featherstone craftily swung his bunger just a little and nicked enough of the steam engine pitcher's cannonball to set it rolling forward. Then it was a race between him and Half-Lip. Alan's hobnails dug the yard and spat up explosions of sand, but Half-Lip's bare feet gripped its prehensile toes around the ball, lifted it up quick, and he slung it like a tomahawk right into the back of Alan's head. Alan stood there, right at the gate of the base, stunned. Old Corporal Tucker, the first base guard, picked up the ball and dispatched the last pioneer of that wagon train. The Chicken Hawks howled savage war whoops and ran in to form rank behind Homestead. We crawdads slunk out and scuttled to our defensive positions all around the Oregon Trail between bases. Franklin Stove puff-puffed Smoky Mountains as he picked up the wadding bunger. Our crawdadian hell pitcher, Sarah herself, stared down at the metal man. I imagine she was giving him the delicious worst of her big black Apache eyes. She squeezed and squeezed George Washington behind her back. I imagined it was my heart. In that quiet moment, I again took notice of the sinister silence coming from over yonder.